This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The race for Cincinnati mayor features City Councilman David Mann and Hamilton County Clerk of Courts Aftab Purval. The two met on stage this week at a debate hosted by The Inquirer, WVXU, and Xavier University. Our senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson characterized this event as chippy, and he said that the race is quiet no more. Well, we want to hear from you on the state of the Cincinnati mayoral campaign and why your vote may be headed one way or the other, or what you're waiting to hear about from these two candidates. You can give us a call at 513-419-7100, or feel free to email talk at wvxu.org with your questions or your comments, and we'll read some of those on the air. We start our weekly news review with the moderator of that debate this week, Inquirer opinion editor Kevin Aldridge. Kevin, welcome back to our show.
Thanks, Michael. Glad to be here.
We also have with us debate panelist and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Hi, Becca.
Good morning, Michael.
Again, the number to call is 513-419-7100. So, Kevin, you were right there smack dab in the middle of these two gentlemen vying to be the next mayor of the Queen City. Was Howard Wilkinson correct? Was it a little chippy? And did it heighten the, I guess, loudness of the campaign?
Yeah, I think Howard categorized it 100% correct. I think David Mann came out very aggressive, I think, against Aftab, and that kind of meets up with what I expected. You know, in my conversations with David leading up to the debate, he was very excited and eager to get in there and I think mix it up with Aftab, and I think he really took it to him. I think if you look at David, he perhaps feels that he's playing with a little bit of house money. And what I mean by that is a lot of people would assume that Aftab is the front runner at this point. And so what do you do when someone is the front runner? You try to chip away at them and their identity. And I think David did that to some degree of success Tuesday night.
That is exactly what I was going to ask you about next, Kevin. Did you get the indication, perhaps, that some polling had been conducted, perhaps, by the Mann campaign that showed him possibly behind, and that might have been why he took the approach that he did?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know for a fact that there was that his campaign had done any polling, but I think the conventional wisdom is that Aftab is the front runner at this point. But if there's one thing I've learned throughout the course of this campaign, it's that you can't underestimate David Mann and his appeal to Cincinnati voters. You know, I personally wrote a column, I think, around this time last year or whenever it was that David Mann walked out of that meeting, that budget meeting, and I thought that was pretty much the end of his mayoral bid. I was wrong about that, and so I'm not going to write him off at this point.
You're talking about the meeting last year where there were police reform advocates in the crowd, and he decided to walk out after some confrontation.
Yes.
Let's bring in Becca Costello from here at WVXU. Becca, these are two Democrats. They are from different generations, of course, and they have different approaches to a lot of the situations that they say face Cincinnati, or that Cincinnati is facing. David Mann is 81 years old. He's been a fixture in local politics since the 1970s. And Aftab Purval, he's 39 years old, but he's been active in politics recently. David Mann was quick to point out that he's run a number of campaigns over the past 5 years. But considering that they're probably aligned generally politically, what issues stood out at this debate this week, Becca, where they were able to define any significant differences?
Well, I think the most clear difference that I noticed, at least, was in response to a question about the collaborative agreement, which the question was intended to ask about how these candidates would fully fund the collaborative agreement, not just the citizen complaint authority, but all aspects of the collaborative. It kind of ended up being more a discussion about kind of police response and how the police are funded, with a response from Purval saying that he would fund the collaborative by basically using resources other than the police to respond to mental health calls. So emergency situations where perhaps an armed police officer is not the best person to respond, and rather a social worker or other sort of more mental health trained person could respond. And Mann kind of fought back on that and said, you know, even if that was possible, and he outlined a couple of reasons why he felt it wasn't logistically possible to do that, but that it wouldn't save enough money to fully fund the collaborative in the way that Purval was talking about. I think that was, you know, like I said, kind of the thing that stood out to me most as a differing approach there. Otherwise, you know, one of my first questions in the debate was how do you distinguish yourself from the other candidate? Because as you said, they're both Democrats, and, you know, to the casual voter might not seem very different on certain issues. The response to that question was really kind of man emphasizing his experience and saying, you know, I don't need to kind of outline my policies because I'm at City Hall every day voting and introducing legislation that talks about that. And Pureville kind of saying, yeah, but voters need to see a clearer idea of what your plan is for the future of the city.
We've got some sound from this week's debate, and I'll ask our technical director, Josh Elstro, to play a couple from the candidates. Let's start, Josh, with a sound from David Mann, soundbite number one.
I think given the youth and inexperience of the next council, and we know that because of term limits, because of the extent to which some of our colleagues are not eligible for re-election, we need somebody who has the experience of being a CEO of all times, whatever the age of the candidate. We need someone who understands how City Hall operates, and I do.
And AFTAB Pureval also had a response to that, and that is clip number two, Josh.
You're right. I don't have any experience in City Hall, but I think that's a good thing. What I've got is a track record of reform, taking a corrupt clerk of court's office that was based on patronage and nepotism, getting rid of the good old boys club that was there, driving efficiency and innovation, and making results for the people of Hamilton County. I believe that's exactly the kind of leadership that Cincinnati needs right now, and that's why I'm running.
You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking about the Cincinnati mayoral debate that took place this week between City Councilman David Mann and Hamilton County Clerk of Courts AFTAB Pureval, the two candidates in this November's election. We're joined by Inquirer opinion editor Kevin Aldridge and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Kevin, we have received some responses from listeners that anti-corruption or corruption, these are the top issues at the top of mind as it relates to campaign for mayor and campaign for city council based on what has happened in recent years and months at City Hall. Three sitting city council members arrested on federal charges related to bribery, one sentenced to prison, two maintaining their innocence at this point. Is there an advantage for someone like AFTAB Pureval being outside of City Hall right now trying to run on a message of reform?
Yeah, I do think there is a slight advantage there. I thought it was interesting how David Mann and AFTAB each kind of tried to address the reforms that AFTAB took at the clerk of court's office. AFTAB sort of held it up as, look, I'm the guy who can come in who's not afraid to make changes, clear out corruption, and bring solid reform to the office. If you're someone who's tired of and believes there's a culture of corruption at City Hall and tired of the way that things have been going the last few years, that appeals to you. I thought it was interesting that David Mann sort of took that and tried to spin it against AFTAB to pretty much kind of say that, almost intimate that he went into the clerk's office and sort of cleaned house. And would he do, you know, is that the same thing he was going to do if he got to City Hall, sort of clear out the city manager and some of the other administration and bring in his own folks. So I think, you know, it'll depend on how those messages resonate with voters. I think David also has to address the situation that, yes, while he stayed clean from the corruption that was currently taking place in City Hall, he was there while it was going on. And one might ask, if they're a voter, why wasn't more... why didn't he do more to address the culture that existed over at City Hall? So I think it'll be interesting to watch how both candidates navigate around that issue.
And Becca, how did you watch both of those candidates this week address those issues?
Well, I think the clips that played really do kind of summarize their positions on this. I think, you know, kind of going off of what Kevin said as well, we hear Mann saying, you know, we need someone in City Hall who knows how it works. And I think what Pureville is saying and what honestly I'm hearing from some voters is, you know, we don't like how City Hall works. We want it to work differently. And so I think that's kind of Pureville's message is, you know, we don't want someone who's been there forever who, you know, understands how it works because it's not working for citizens. And so, you know, he wants to kind of change how things work. Kevin mentioned the city manager, for example. That was one of the rapid fire questions at the end that Kevin asked. And those responses, one from Mann being, you know, I think Paula Boggs-Meething, the current city manager, is doing a great job and she would absolutely stay. And that did kind of play into his message of things are going pretty well. Let's build on the growth, the economic growth in particular of the last 8 years with Mayor Cranley. And then Pierville's response to that was that he wants to conduct a national search and find someone that really is on board with his vision for what he wants to see done. And so again, just kind of looking at Mann saying, you know, we've got some progress here. Let's build on that and move forward. Whereas Pierville saying a little bit, you know, not just with the reform, but just kind of in general, let's move in a different direction.
And I'll turn back to our technical director, Josh Elstro, so we can hear a little bit more from this week's debate. Josh, let's hear from David Mann, clip number three.
Now, Mr. Pierville is very happy that he has some plans. And with all respect, I've read those plans, each as they've been produced. They are general. They are fond of saying, the city has done well here, the city has done well here. It can do better, however. And by the way, we've read about good things happening in Baltimore, Minneapolis, Chicago, Philadelphia. We should look at those. Well, you know what? We're looking at those. And that's what I do all the time. I don't need a plan. My job as a member of council, particularly as chair of the Budget and Finance Committee, is to make sure that our city departments, our city manager, are on top of the needs of our city, proposing initiatives, and we approve them.
And we also heard from AFTAB Pierville in clip number four, Josh.
Mr. Mann, I'm glad that you admit that you don't need a plan because you don't have a plan. I think we're at a critical point in our city's history right now. And instead of just running on a campaign of trust me, when four of your colleagues have been indicted for corruption, I'm running on a campaign of ideas and specifics. And again, given the opportunity to share his vision, instead of doing that, he talked about me the entire time.
Kevin Aldridge is the opinion editor at the Cincinnati Inquirer and was the moderator of this debate between David Mann and AFTAB Pierville. And so what I'm hearing there, and I think that might have been just one example of what our Howard Wilkinson characterizes as a bit chippy, because those particular areas of argument weren't about policy. They just seem to be to chip away at each other personally over the course of this campaign. And I'm wondering what we're supposed to make of what the strategy is here. Is what we're hearing David Mann talking about, I've got a lot of experience, and AFTAB Pierville saying you've been in office too long. Is it tricky to kind of balance that? Like, I've got a lot of experience in office, and another guy saying, no, that's too long to build up that much experience. Do we have Kevin?
Oh, yes.
I think that was
I wasn't sure who you were going to ask that question.
I got lost midway in that myself. I apologize to you and our listeners for that one.
No, not at all. I wasn't sure if you were directing that question to me or Becca. So, I think it was kind of the same position that we saw Joe Biden in the presidential race. You know, one of the things that criticisms of him was he'd been in Washington for 40 some odd years. You know, what had he done? You know, and David Mann is going to face those same questions, the same questions about age and how long he's been in office. And that is going to be something that he's going to have to navigate. I mean, I think this race basically comes down to sort of change versus the status quo. If you want change, I think AFTAB is the candidate who is trying to represent change. I think David Mann is the candidate who's representing, as Becca said, hey, let's build off of the last 8 years. We're on the right trajectory. I think David feels like the city is going in the right direction. And I think he wants to build on what has been going on in the last 8 years. I think so. If you think the last 8 years have been great in Cincinnati and you want to maintain the status quo and you don't like the changes that AFTAB is talking about, then I think David Mann is your man. But AFTAB is bringing a lot of plans. Now, my one criticism of AFTAB, and I think this is where David sort of made a strong point, is AFTAB does have a lot of ideas. I think what he is going to have to do and convince voters of is how do you make those ideas reality? Because David is right. Cincinnati has had a lot of plans over the years. And what we've seen is, you know, these plans very rarely come to fruition. There have been a lot of great ideas and teams sent to other cities to study things and bring things back to Cincinnati. And we just haven't seen those things materialize. A lot of that maybe because of the budget situation and finances. And so I think AFTAB is going to have to explain to voters how he's going to make these ideas that he have a reality and pay for them. One thing that stood out to me from the debate that I remember, there was a question that came up about funding the collaborative and how he was going to fund it. And AFTAB's answer was, well, I think the way that you fund the collaborative is to fund it. And I recall sitting there in the moderating chair like, well, give us some specifics on exactly where that money is going to come from. So I think that that's something that he's going to have to work on here in the weeks before the election is the ideas. Ideas always sound great, but how do you make them reality and where do you find the money to pay for them?
We've got a caller on the line that we'll take now. Let's go to Ruth. Hi, Ruth. What's your question or comment?
Oh, okay. Thank you. Comment. I would be voting for AFTAB and two reasons. First, I see what he's done at the clerk of courts, and he saved us a lot of money. And so there's a saying that was, if you want to know about a person, look at their past history, not just what they say. And the second thing is, I do know him a little and his wife. He has a two-year-old son, a wife who's an MD and works in the COVID unit in her hospital. Probably part-time, I'm not sure of that. And that gives him the health aspect. And I think with a family, he's going to want to make Cincinnati great for his family, and that's going to overflow to all of us in Cincinnati.
Ruth, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us. And I've got a couple more clips I want to play from the debate this week between David Mann and AFTAB Purival, the two candidates for Cincinnati mayor. Josh Elstro, our technical director, can you play clip number five for us, David
Mann?
My
opponent is likes to talk about what he did on day one. Well, let me tell you what on day one as the newly elected clerk. He fired 15 longtime employees for the reason that they were not of his political party. That's not the kind of reformation that anybody should be proud of. That should not happen. I have never terminated somebody because of their party.
And we also heard from AFTAB Purival in clip number six.
David, I guess I'm a little bit surprised that that you think the clerk of court's office was running just fine. I know your Republican supporters have convinced you that in order to make this race competitive, you've got to tear me down. But that's what people are tired of. David, people want to move on from that.
Becca Costello is WVXU's local government reporter and was a panelist during the debate this week. And to build on what Kevin just said about the Joe Biden reference, that exchange also seemed similar because it seems that David Mann sees an opportunity for himself. These are two Democrats, but there are Republican voters still in Cincinnati. Are you getting the sense that David Mann is hoping to get some Democrats, but also what else might be out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's no question about that. And, you know, something that we saw or that we've been seeing is support for Mann from, for example, Republican Councilmember Betsy Sunderman, who's been very supportive of Mann's campaign and is one of the more conservative Republicans of the Republicans on council. And so I think that's definitely something that Mann is shooting for. He's definitely promoting himself as a bit more moderate. And I think on issues like we talked about criminal justice already today, but that was another issue where Mann tried to distance himself from the slightly more progressive side of the Democratic Party that Purival represents, and him saying, you know, I feel like Purival is criticizing the police and that's what he's running on, and I don't support that. And there was some back and forth on that, and Purival denied that he was critical of police officers. But I think that that was one example of Mann kind of messaging himself in a way that is more aligned with some of the Republican voters. So whether or not that pans out for him, I think we'll see. You know, as Kevin has said, Purival seems to be the front runner. And so I think Mann is hoping to have a bit of that Republican vote to give him more of an edge. But we'll see how that plays out.
Kevin, is there enough runway for that kind of campaign? We've seen Cincinnati and even Hamilton County overall trend very blue in more recent elections. Is there a path for David Mann to build a coalition to overtake any momentum that AFTAB Purival may have?
Yeah, I think, David, it's a very delicate line that David has to walk because he can't come off appearing to be too Republican in a very Democratic city. I did get a couple of text messages from some folks who had referred to David as the Republican candidate following the debate based on some of the comments that he had made. So I think while it is perhaps smart strategically to try to get some of that Republican conservative vote, because I think there's a larger picture here. I mean, I think when you look at AFTAB in a larger picture, I think that there are many conservatives who don't want to see AFTAB be mayor, not just because of his progressive ideas, but because of the platform that it might give him for future elections. So if you're conservatives or Republicans concerned about him being a threat potentially, you certainly don't want to see him be the mayor of Cincinnati. You know, David Mann, at his age and at this particular point in his career, he's not likely to pursue a higher office after the mayor of Cincinnati. So I think there's politics behind the support for David Mann that goes beyond just AFTAB's immediate policy positions in this race. So I think David has to be very careful because he still needs the core of his base, which are Democratic voters, to come out and vote for him. And I think it's a thin line he's got to walk to not seem like he's sort of switching sides here. So he's got to be very careful about that messaging.
Well, we've got just over a month left in this campaign. There will be more forums and debates, and we will have conversations with the candidates here on Cincinnati Edition. I think we'll be part of an upcoming debate again as well. Kevin Aldridge is the opinion editor at the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Becca Costello is the WVXU local government reporter. Kevin, Becca, thank you so much for spending some time with us and breaking down this debate with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, the rate of COVID cases is higher in school districts where masks are not required. We talk about a new study from Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And later, the Cincinnati Reds limping to the finish line after flirting with a playoff spot. And what to expect on the football field this weekend. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Even as COVID cases surged again in the late summer ahead of the new school year, many districts returned to full classrooms and no requirement on masking. But now a study from Cincinnati Children's Hospital shows districts requiring masks are having fewer positive cases. We're joined now by Inquirer reporter Terry DeMio. Terry, thank you so much for coming back on our show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I shouldn't editorialize, but I find it a bit shocking that here we are 18 months into this pandemic talking about a study that says masks are beneficial in the fight against COVID. But that's basically what this is.
That's correct. And, you know, Cincinnati Children's pediatricians have talked quite publicly about the effectiveness of masks for more than a year now. And they've been using often a study that the World Health Organization kind of put out there that looked at several countries' mask application and what has happened over what happened over a period of time. And that study showed that 85% effective. But I suspect that what was, you know, I can't say for sure, but I think that they probably thought, let's do our own study. What's happening right here in our yard? And people know Cincinnati Children's, and they know their schools and the schools in the area. So, you know, I don't think that the outcome was that surprising, but that it might be helpful to check it out.
What does seem surprising, Terry, is that the governor, Mike DeWine, had said recently in one of his COVID briefings that apparently just about one of every three school districts in Ohio requires mask. And, Kentucky had its controversy, its legal battle between the governor and the legislature, or some parents and some schools and all of that, when he had mandated masks in schools. And then he lost that ability. And so the state left it up to the districts. And nearly every school district in Kentucky, only a small handful, have opted not to mandate masks. And so it's going to be interesting to watch what the overall outcome of that is as we proceed into the school year. But I was a bit surprised to hear the governor say that only a third of the school districts. So what did this study show as it relates to percentages in of COVID cases in districts that had universal masking and those that didn't?
So for those that did not have universal masking, they had a 78% higher rate of COVID cases. That could be children or adults. It's just COVID cases, from what I understand. So there you go. I mean, that's so close to that 85% that we talked about.
And the challenge with districts, of course, is that you don't want a kid to be positive or a staff member to be positive, not just because of the health concerns around that individual, but if a student was close to that other student or that faculty member or that staff member, suddenly we're talking about quarantines. And that's when you see districts shut down.
That's right. And actually, one of the things that Dr. Auger has been heading up is finding out what needs to be done to keep our kids in school. She is a hospitalist, which means she treats children who are hospitalized. But for this pandemic, she's been working on, you know, finding out and advising schools and just learning about what helps keep all of our children in school, which she says, you know, is where they need to be. And of course, quarantines were out of control in 2020. And, you know, this is another effect that masking has. If you are, if you have more masked students, staff, you're going to end up with fewer quarantines because there are fewer cases of COVID.
And we're talking with Terry DeMeo of the Cincinnati Inquirer. And you're talking about Dr. Catherine Auger, a pediatrician at Cincinnati Children's. According to your reporting on this, Dr. Auger was surprised at how big of a difference there was. Did she elaborate at all on what was surprising about the difference between universal masking in schools and those that aren't?
Not really. I mean, she said that it was a little surprising to her that in just 3 weeks, she got such dramatic results because she had only, you know, started this study, well, as school began. And so that was maybe mid-August, and here we were in after about the first week of September, and she already had dramatic results. So that was the only indication for her surprise.
Now, when they were looking at school districts, was this a randomized study, or were there invitations for districts to participate? And if so, were there local districts that participated?
They've had a whole group of districts that has been, you know, in kind of in communication with Cincinnati Children's. And, I honestly don't know what the method of that was, but I know that people such as the Wyoming superintendent has been, you know, following Cincinnati Children's for a while. And I think what they were just looking for was a balance between the schools that provided universal masking and those that didn't. And it was a pretty minimal number of districts that were involved in this study, to be honest. It was about seven. I think it was seven.
Terry, you talked to another medical expert at Cincinnati Children's, one who is probably very familiar to our listeners as well. We've talked to him a lot during the pandemic. That's Dr. Robert Frank. He's director of the Gamble Center for Vaccine Research at Cincinnati Children's. And so we're starting apparently to talk more about COVID vaccines for younger kids. Can you tell us about the conversation you had with Dr. Frank as it relates to the latest information?
Yes, Dr. Frank has, from the start, and you're right, he's very well known as a vaccine expert, across the world, really, in the, whatever those circles may be. And he has, you know, he's very supportive of vaccines at work. And he was a lead investigator in some of the Pfizer studies for adults and children. And he's very confident in the results that they are seeing, both in the Cincinnati Children's clinical studies and nationally. He's very much in favor of kids getting the vaccine. And he notes that, okay, it is true. People will say, well, it's very unlikely for a young child to be severely sick with COVID-19 or require hospitalization or die. And he says, yes, that is true. But there have been something like, and I don't remember the exact number at the moment, like more than 500 deaths. And he says, we don't know who the child will be, you know, which child is going to have these severe, the severe disease and or die. And it just, he feels, makes sense for safety protection to get your kids vaccinated when it's approved.
And it looks like the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine might be first in line for kids who are between the ages of 5 and 11. What do we know about the dose itself? We know that the vaccine makeup is probably the same as what those of us who are adults and who received the Pfizer vaccine got jabbed with. But what do we know about the size of the dose? Is it different for kids?
Yeah, it's about a third of the size of the adult dose. That he wants to make it clear, Dr. Frank wants to make it clear, that doesn't mean that they're giving a partial dose. What they do with the children of young ages is kind of test to see what dose, lesser than an adult dose, will still be just as effective. And they found that they could go down to 10 micrograms, I think it was, roughly 10 micrograms, as opposed to the adults, 12 and up, of about 30 micrograms of the vaccine. But yes, he says it is the same vaccine. And, you know, if it's effective, providing the antibodies, immune necessities at a lower dose, that's what they want to do. And that's what it turned out to be.
Terry, what was Dr. Frank's advice for vaccine hesitant parents? I imagine that this might even include some parents who received the vaccine for themselves, but might have concerns about their younger kids.
Yeah, he says it's very safe. And, you know, this has been shown in efficacy. He also says that in the amount, if you look at the amount of time that we've had vaccine now for COVID, we have seen a couple of, unexpected effects. But that, in what he says, is that we have seen everything that's going to happen. And in those cases, those cases were extremely rare. And he says it is far safer, he says, you know, and healthier to get it than to not.
That's Terry DeMeo of the Cincinnati Inquirer. Terry, we always appreciate when you can take the time to join our program and hope to talk to you again soon. Have a great weekend.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Michael.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Autumn is here. We're saying hello to sweaters, outside fires, pumpkin spice, and goodbye to baseball. And that farewell to baseball can't come soon enough for some Reds fans who have watched the home team collapse at the end of what was looking like a promising season. Sports radio host Andy Furman is on the phone with me now. Hello, Andy.
Man, what's going on? You know, you see, it's the end of the summer, and it's the end of baseball, only in Cincinnati. And not in St. Louis, but in Cincinnati it's over, really. You know, I got to say something. This is an amazing statistic. The St. Louis Cardinals, back on the 5th of August, were 53 wins and 55 losses. That's unreal what they do. But it's a history situation with the St. Louis Cardinals. And you know what? No one's talking about Adam Wainwright, the pitcher. This guy's 40 years old. He's turned back the clock. He is 16-7, ERA 289, 30 starts. This is unbelievable what the Cardinals have done.
Okay, first of all, I'm 40 years old. Is this old now? Is this something? Should I not be able to throw a ball around?
I'm sorry. Put an asterisk there for baseball players.
I'm kidding. I hurt myself getting out of the car this morning, so I completely understand. Listen, what happened to the Reds? Because it was just a few weeks ago where we were thinking, hey, this might be possible. This might be the year they're back in the playoffs in a really strong fashion. A more traditional year that they're back in the playoffs. And they even have a favorable schedule for the most part, but they're getting beat by Washington.
You know, I really think they played at least to the capacity or maybe above so. This team was beat up a little bit. And honestly, I don't think anybody expected them to go postseason. Maybe some did. Obviously, the faithful fans did. But you look at a guy like Luis Castillo, their pitcher, Luis Castillo, was 8-15. I mean, September, he came on so much strong. He did a decent job against the Dodgers, but the 17th of September, he didn't allow a runner past second base in about 7 innings. So he threw a season-high 111 pitches, gave up 2 walks. The Reds did lose the final 2 games of the series with the Dodgers. And the Reds now 6-14 since August 28th. That's not good. Injury factors, Jesse Winker, their third base situation was done. You look at Mike Moustakas, how much weight has this guy gained? I mean, the guy looks like a balloon, really. I mean, Mike Moustakas right now, I saw him the other day, he must have gained like 40 pounds. And I understand you're not playing, you got the foot injury, you're laying around, maybe you're not doing rehabbing, I don't know what you're doing, but I know what you are doing. Put the fork down, Michael!
Oh
Mike, put
goodness.
The fork down, please! It's unbelievable what he looks like!
Well, that of course is the opinion of Andy Furman, and not one that I necessarily support.
Not WVXU, of course.
But let me just say, Andy, look, at this point there's, what, 9 games left in the regular season. The Reds are 3 games above 500. They're 5.5 games in the wild card, back in the wild card, the wild card behind St. Louis. Technically, mathematically possible for something to happen in their favor. Not likely at this point, but is there any morale boost? Is there anything important for the Reds at this point? Is there something that they can still achieve?
I think the morale boost is the re-signing of David Bell. I think he's kept this team together.
I wanted to ask you about that, because
they love him. They love David Bell. They really do.
So tell me what's important about David Bell as manager of this Reds team and how you manage expectations in a year like this.
Well, I will tell you this much. I think Major League Baseball manager, you have to know the game. I think everybody does who manages Major League Baseball. I think what separates the good from the great managers is how you handle individuals. And I think that David Bell obviously protects his players. You've never, ever seen him go to the press, to the media, to bang a player, criticize a player. It's all one. It's all good. Everything's positive. They lose, we still have tomorrow. Better things ahead. He keeps them together. The morale is high. They love him. They support him, and he supports them. I think that's the key. You know what? I'd rather have a guy who maybe knows less baseball but is more attuned to what's going on in the clubhouse, and that's what David Bell is. He's a rally guy. He's a good guy, and he is a baseball guy. So I'm glad they re-signed him for 2 years, because 1 year, meanwhile, when you get a one-year deal, like, you're walking the plank. I mean, it's like a no-deal situation. I mean, it's just you're counting the days. And I thought perhaps they'd let him go this year, but I'm so happy they gave him the two-year deal, because certainly he deserved it. He didn't have much bullpen help, and the front office didn't do much to help him either. So I think he did the best he could with what he had.
So if we're Reds fans, Andy, and we're watching sort of a disappointing end of the season, if your expectation was at one point that they'd be in the playoffs, what kind of moves should we watch for this organization to make in the upcoming offseason?
They need bullpen help. You know, I think they got to sign some free agencies. I think the catching situation, there's a possibility of them losing a catcher. But, you know, I think by and large, I think they're in pretty good shape. I don't know if Moustakas comes back. I really don't. He's a big salary kind of guy. But I think the nucleus is there. I think the infield is there. The India guy at second base, I think that's a tremendous positive. Joey Votto, I mean, what's he got left in the tank? I don't know. I mean, you know, he had a good run when he had, those 7 home runs in 8 games or whatever back in late July, early August. But, you know, you can't do it consistently. And I keep on hearing Joey Votto Hall of Famer. I don't know. If I had a Hall of Fame vote, I'd question that. I really would, because you're going against a great position, first base. And honestly, you know, a guy has had a couple of great years. Other than that, I mean, what has he done? Longevity does not mean that you're going to be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, just kind of a fan favorite situation.
No doubt. Yes.
Well, the Reds are probably finished for the year, which is all right. We can live for another season. But the Bengals are back, and it's early. They've split the first 2 games. They won in overtime against the Vikings to open the season and lost a close one at Chicago last week. And this weekend, Sunday, 1:00, They're at the Steelers. And, you know, that's always a tough game for Bengals fans and obviously the Bengals themselves. What should we expect of this team this year?
You know, it's funny because there was a time back in the day when the Steelers were at home, it was almost a lock. It was a lock win. They lost last week to Las Vegas in Pittsburgh, 26-17. And right now the Steelers are somewhat beaten up. We don't know about Ben Roethlisberger because he may play. I'm sure he's going to play, but I don't think it's 100%. But their linebacker, T.J. Watt, Devin Bush may be out, cornerback Joe Hayden. If these guys are out and the Bengals have a pretty good offense and they pass the football, please. I mean, they were down against the Bears last week and they were going against the Bears being down and going against the clock and they're still running the football. Pass the ball, please. And if they could do that, and I know Joe did throw three interceptions and he was sacked a couple of times, nine times in two games. Keep him upright, pass the football, do some protection. And the defense, kudos to them. They played well last week. I think they got a shot. I don't think they're going to win. You know, if you were to ask me to score right now, I would say Steelers 21, Bengals 17. I don't think they could do it. I just don't think they can.
It's interesting that, I mean, if the score were to look something like that, Andy, that would be pretty similar to the two games they played, very close. Or right. Is that the kind of team we expect this year, is one that might be able to hang around but might not get the number of wins?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, Michael, I think that, you know, you're climbing the mountain. You take one step up and maybe two steps back. They're making progress, but progress takes time. And I don't think people realize one thing, that the division that they're in with Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and Baltimore, that may be the second toughest division in the National Football League. It's going to be tough. They may get three teams in that division to go postseason. They really might. So people don't talk about that as much as they talk about what the Bengals should do and how many games they should win. They're in a tough situation right now. They really are. They're growing, but you got to expect growing pains.
Well, what do you think about Joe Burrow so far? I mean, he certainly looks good and healthy. You know, he looks the part of a quarterback, and he looks like he's come back from that injury pretty well. As far as, you know, talking to the press afterwards, he seems very self-assured and that sort of thing. He's very good at talking to the media. But on the field, what do you think of him so far this season?
I think Joe Burrow has the winning pedigree. He was a great player at LSU. I think he brings that confidence to the huddle. But I think that the sacks that he has had in the last two games, nine games, you can't blame them all on the defense and on the offensive line. I think that Joe Burrow right now may be losing a step or so because of that knee, getting out of the situation, getting out of the problem, getting out of the rush that's going to him. I would watch him very carefully against Pittsburgh this Sunday to see if the sacks are not so much offensive line help, or lack thereof, or the fact that Joe Burrow just does not have the mobility that he once had, or maybe the fear of the knee. Who knows? We'll see. Time will tell. But I will tell you this much. The one person on God's green earth that is really upset about this should be Joe Burrow's mother. Joe Burrow's mom should be saying, please take care of my son. Take care of my boy. That's what she's saying right now. I promise you.
I love that. We're talking with Fox Sports Radio host Andy Furman about sports in the Cincinnati area. And fortunately, regardless of the Bengals' start so far, there's another football team in town that's got people pumped and excited, and that is the 8th-ranked Cincinnati Bearcats. And boy, do they have a big game coming up here soon when they travel to South Bend. And let's talk a little bit about where the Bearcats are. That was quite a game last week where they came back and won in Bloomington against Indiana and really showed some strength. A lot of questions about whether they're really a top-10 team, are they?
Well, I think right now it's so much open in football right now. You got Alabama, and after that it's almost like you shake them up in a jar and you see what's up next. I mean, Georgia's going to be number two. Clemson's not that good. I don't think they are. Oklahoma's really not that good. I think this could be the year, if the Bearcats put it together and run the table, they could be in the Final Four. However, I would say there's one common thing that's happened in the last several games. They don't get out to that quick start. It was 7-7 against Murray State in the first half when they played here at Nippert several weeks ago, and against Indiana, they were a different team in the second half as they were in the first half. So they got to get off to that quick start. The one thing I'm upset about is the fact when they did play Indiana, Indiana was not ranked in the top 25, which I don't know if it's going to help or hurt. It certainly would have helped more so if, in fact, Indiana was a ranked team. The good news is Cincinnati went out of the non-conference schedule and played some toughies, some name opponents, Indiana and Notre Dame, and they got to beat Notre Dame. They got to beat them at Notre Dame and beat them handily. A lot of storylines on that game. You know, the fact that in Notre Dame is ranked behind Cincinnati in the rankings right now, number one, and of course the Brian Kelly story.
Absolutely, and also the story that Cincinnati is moving to a football powerhouse conference, and you know, do they have a lot of work to do to prepare for that type of week in and week out schedule?
You know, I would say this, the Big 12 is tremendous. I can't wait. I can't wait to see Kansas come to town to play basketball here. I can't wait to see Oklahoma State and Baylor come here to play football. I don't think many people have realized this, but I think the demand for tickets is going to be so high. I would think that Cincinnati will have to move some of their home games to Paul Brown Stadium. I really believe that. I don't think they're going to be able to play all their games in it, but Paul Brown Stadium may be a new home or a secondary home for Cincinnati football. But I'm going to tell you this. If, in fact, Cincinnati does beat Notre Dame, and then Cincinnati has a kind of a setback against one of those American Athletic Conference foes, like a Temple or someone, God forbid, if they lose to one of those games, that means they'll be done, finished, gonzo, as far as any postseason hopes in the Final Four playoffs. I would predict that Luke Fickell will be gone before Cincinnati enters the Big 12.
Oh.
He would leave. It's got to be frustrating as anything to just lose one game and your whole season goes down the crapper for losing one game, and there you go, a Final Four situation. There's going to be teams like Ohio State already lost one game. They could run the table in their conference and the Big Ten and still go postseason, go to the Final Four. That will never happen in Cincinnati's case.
All right. Well, look, Andy, you and I both live on the Kentucky side of things. I've got 30 seconds left. NKU doesn't have a football team, so I can't ask you about Norse football because it doesn't exist. But I am a UK, University of Kentucky Wildcat football fan every Saturday, and they're off to a decent start. Are they for real this year?
Yes, they are. Yeah, you know what? I'd like to see them do well. I really do. I mean, it's been known, obviously, as a basketball school. Football is just, you know, something you wait until basketball starts. But they've come a long way. They really have. And I think that, at least this year, I think they've passed Louisville. That's their big rival, of course. And I think that they're a better football program this year than Louisville is.
Andy Furman, Fox Sports Radio host. Always a pleasure to chat with you, buddy. Thanks for spending some time with me.
The pleasure's all yours, Michael. I love you.
I love you, too. We'll talk again soon, I hope. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our Facebook live stream is produced by Ronnie Salerno. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.